Ladies and gentlemen, our session now is on character and public life, and our speakers, David Brooks has written a best-selling New York Times book now called The Road to Character. But before that book came out, James Davison Hunter is a sociologist at University of Virginia, wrote a book on character called The Death of Character, Moral Education in an Age Without Good or Evil. That came out in the year 2000. Professor Hunter is most well known for his earlier book over 20 years ago called Culture Wars, where he diagnosed the current, the battles that were coming and occurring in American culture. And so we've had James here before talking about culture wars, but now we have him going first to talk about this question of character in public life. And we couldn't have two better people to address the question for us, so we're really grateful for Dr. Hunter and for David Brooks to join us. If you want to know more about any of them, their bios are in your packet. James, you're on. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I've said before that as an academic coming to the Faith Angle conference, one of the best seminars in America, that it's like being invited to host Saturday Night Live, you know, and you count the number of times you do it, and there's a kind of status system by being invited a lot. So this is my third or fourth time. Yeah. So anyway, I'm very grateful to be here. Thank you. I have been asked to reflect on David's new book, The Road to Character. I have been, among other things. Sure. we'll get. So I've been in academia too long to assume that students ever fully prepare for my seminars. And given the busyness of your lives, I don't assume that all of you have read and fully digested David's book. Now, I hope that David will correct me and fill out. But to get us on the same page, let me just recap the very broad contours of his argument. The Road to Character is a book about the tensions between what he cleverly calls resume virtues and eulogy virtues, between the virtues of performance and accomplishment and the virtues of transcendence and enduring ideals. The tension is not new, but ancient, and it is reflected in two sides of our nature, what Rabbi Soloveitchik called Adam 1 and Adam 2, the active building creative versus the contemplative more spiritual. This binary is not only old, but also deep, for it roughly maps on to other classical dualisms in Western thought, mind versus soul, materiality versus spirituality, the vita activa versus the vita contemplativa, the sacred versus the profane, and as you got a foretaste this morning from my comments or my question to Jamie, not insignificantly, again, for my own public, my reflections here, the dualism between public and private. The Road to Character is not an argument about the unimportance or meaninglessness of Adam 1 or resume virtues, but rather it's an account of the way in which Adam 1 virtues have come to displace Adam 2 virtues. In turn, it is an account of the insufficiency of the resume virtues, absent the guiding, chastening vitality of the eulogy virtues. Inevitably, this is a story about the impoverishment of life and sociality in that follow in its wake in the late modern period. This account is brought to life by the stories, many biographies really, of eight extraordinary people, the hardship they faced, the suffering they endured, their failure, disappointments, but also their triumphs, all often enough hidden from public view. At the same time, it is a recounting of the reservoirs of humility, courage, and vision, in short, their strength of character that they drew upon to lead such exemplary lives. The Road to Character is not without its implications toward practice either, applications that David gestures toward in suggesting ways in which we might recover this older way of understanding and living. Despite a few snarky reviews from the literati, The Road to Character has struck a chord, no question about it. There is a palpable hunger for the moral depth and idealism he has written about, a hunger made all the more ravenous by the shocking debasements of public virtue by our political class. For my own part, recognizing what I think are limitations to the book doesn't keep me from acknowledging that this is a beautiful book, a courageous book, a thought-provoking book, and at nearly every page, an inspiring book. Part of what makes The Road to Character distinctive is that it is simultaneously an expression of personal yearning, an act of collective memory tinged with lament, an exercise in cultural analysis, and a work of self-help filled with insight and wisdom. The combination makes the book perplexing at times, but it also makes it rich and compelling. This combination is undoubtedly why it has struck a chord. At the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture at UVA, we say that apart from the joys of inquiry and scholarship, pursuits that have their own integrity and that possess their own justification, the way you know you are succeeding in your work is when you are changing the conversation. Against the cynicism of some of his critics, David's book, along with so much of his other writing at the New York Times, has gone a long way toward changing the conversation about the nature and possibilities of the moral life in America at the start of the 21st century. This is long overdue, and I, for one, am most grateful. My comments this afternoon are, at this point, not so much about David's book, but about the larger conversation he has helped to start. In the ways of a somewhat old-fashioned form of literary criticism, I would like to use The Road to Character as a jumping-off point for thinking about the nature of the predicament he talks about, and that I agree we are in. My reflections are not only, but they're mainly about language. So let me launch in by talking a little bit about the nature of the predicament, and I want to begin with a story. I taught a graduate seminar this past fall on culture and morality. And at one point at the beginning of a seminar, I laid out this scenario. This is actually a scenario that comes from some research I did a few years back. I'm from a tough and impoverished neighborhood, and I'm selling drugs, some of them to kids. And so I asked the class, tell me, is this right or wrong? The class, of course, in unison said yes. And I said, so tell me why.
They said, yes, it's wrong.
They said, yes, it is wrong. It should be really clear, right? They said it was wrong. And I said, so tell me, why is it wrong? Just to be really clear. And one student pipes up and said, well, it's against the law. You'll likely get caught. I said, okay. That's a utilitarian logic. I get that. But let's say I respond and say, I don't care. My life is shit. I'll take my chances. Another student said, well, then how does it make you feel when you do this? Playing the role, I said, well, actually pretty good. It gives me money, influence, and respect. And the student came back and said, yes, but it's harmful to people. And I, continuing to play the role, said, sure, maybe so, but we live in a free country. People have the right to choose. If they choose to buy this stuff, it's not my problem. And then there was silence. On another day, I asked a question, is it wrong to disparage people on the basis of their race or gender? And the class, of course, said, yes, of course it's wrong. I said, so tell me why. And I think they were taken back by the question. And a student finally said, well, it just is. It's obvious. I said, no, tell me why it's wrong. And the student said, well, it's unfair. And I said, well, explain. How is it unfair? There was silence, and then finally a student said, well, how would you like it if you were treated this way? And I said, well, So that's an ethic of reciprocity based on empathy. But then I could say, well, I wouldn't like it at all, but I'm in a position of power and privilege, so it doesn't matter how I would feel. Tell me why it's wrong now. Give me a compelling reason. And again, silence. But I will say, these are grad students. But then, just as the conversation was trailing off, a Catholic kid from Louisiana, who rarely said anything in class, yells out, "It's wrong because all people are made in the image of God. People of other races and genders are our neighbors, and we will be held to account for how we love them." I said, "Okay, now that's interesting. We'll come back to that." Both of these exchanges reflect something important. It isn't as though there is no morality at play in our culture. Conservatives are wrong when they speak about our culture being amoral. They're just wrong about that. You could hear moral logics at play, a utilitarian logic, a therapeutic expressivist logic, the logic of empathy based upon reciprocity. Moral judgments are made all of the time, and they were here as well. Rather, the problem is that our moral languages are thin, and the moral resources that we have to draw upon from to make sense of the moral complexities of life are sparse. David says on page 15, and I quote, "We are morally inarticulate. We are not more selfish or venal than people in other times, but we've lost the understanding of how character is built," end quote. I agree, and the consequences of this are as problematic as he says they are. As individuals and as a society, the moral language available to us is simply not adequate for the challenges that we face. But leading into this observation, David says something that I did balk at. He says, and I quote, "My general belief is that we've accidentally left this moral tradition," what he calls, quoting Kant, "the crooked timber moral tradition," behind. "Over the last several decades, we've lost this language, this way of organizing life." But my question is, and sort of the lead-in to what I'd like to say, mainly like to say, is, but is it accidental? Are we culpable for losing this language? Now, I don't want to make too much of that sentence or that word, accidental, except to use it as a rhetorical hook for my for the major point that I want to make. I think that the story is more complicated. Later on in the book, chapter 10, the chapter entitled The Big Me, David talks about the turn toward narcissism as embedded in the cultural shift from moral realism to moral romanticism. That this cultural shift was reinforced by economic and technological changes, communications, social media, self-referencing and information environment, the meritocracy, and so on. This is entirely true, no disagreement here. But it is on this point of how we got here that I'd like to push the argument and suggest that the problem goes deeper, that the road to character is actually much more arduous, particularly under the conditions of modernity and late modernity. In putting forth this suggestion, I'd like to frame the problem in light of some theoretical considerations. Okay? I apologize. This is sort of the academic dues that you have to pay to hear this. This may seem like a descent into jargon, but I promise you it's not.
You sure?
I promise. All right, great. So I want to begin with something about the nature of institutions. Now, there's lots to say about this, but I want to begin with the philosophical anthropology that underwrites a theory of institutions. Human beings are distinguished from other species by virtue of the fact that we are instinctually deprived. Now, there may be other things as well, but this we know. Unlike other species, we are instinctually deprived. Birds know how to fly, fish know how to swim, giraffes know what to eat, what not to eat. We humans, by contrast, don't know the things we need to survive. We are unfinished at birth. It's against the back cloth of our biology that we see the significance of institutions. You see, institutions, which are merely deeply embedded patterns of thought, behavior, and relationship, are human constructions that provide for us what our biology does not. Institutions function like instincts, in that they pattern individual conduct and social relationship and our thinking in a habitual and socially predictable manner. Not only do they establish behavior with a stable pattern, but institutions also provide human experience at the cognitive level with an intelligibility and a sense of continuity. By living within the well-defined parameters of an ecosystem of such institutions, we humans need not reflect on our actions. We can take our social world for granted. In this sense, they exist as a background against which a foreground of deliberation, thought, and choice can occur. So, I just want you to have this image in your mind. Basically, what I'm arguing is that human experience at some level is divided between foreground, and background, okay? The background is that part of human experience that is embedded within institutions. This is part of our world, our experience that is taken for granted. We don't have to think about it. It seems natural to us, okay? So when I stick out my hand, Michael and David, they don't think I'm attacking them. They probably don't think I'm asking them for money. They know immediately what to do. They reach out and shake my hand. It's the way we in the West greet each other, right? It's taken for granted. It's not thought about. And they never saw a YouTube video about how to do it.
Oh, I had no idea.
They were socialized into it. It has become part of the background of their experience. Think about clothing. When we wake up in the morning, we don't think, gee whiz, I wonder if I'm going to get dressed this morning. It's awfully hot in Miami. Maybe I won't wear a thing. Of course you're going to get dressed. And the only real question is, what are you going to wear? That deliberation happens in the foreground. So foreground and background. I'm going to come back to that in a minute.
Take the mic with you.
Okay, next time I will. All right. So how is this relevant? Let me make three observations, more of a historical nature as it bears on our contemporary moment. The first observation is this. To make a long story short, under the conditions of modernity and late modernity, the background of stable institutional patterns is receding, and the foreground of choice is growing. Okay? You really want me to take this? I'll just be.
It won't go far.
So, under the conditions of modernity and late modernity, the realm in which we have to deliberate, think about, and choose is expanding. That area that is taken for granted in the background of our experience is receding. Okay? This is what social theorists call deinstitutionalization. Now, that does sound like jargon, but it's useful. And it's certainly not referring to the mainstreaming of mental patients, for example. Deinstitutionalization, things that were in the background that we used to take for granted, are now matters of choice and deliberation. All right? This is what social theorists call deinstitutionalization. But here an important qualification. The foreground expands primarily in the private sphere, the realm of personal identity, intimacy, sexuality, courtship, marriage, parenting, religious belief, consumption patterns, and to the point of our conversation this afternoon, it extends to the realm of the language of morality, of virtue, of the good, and thus of character. All of these things have been radically deinstitutionalized. Deinstitutionalization spills into the public sphere, but it's mainly operating in the private sphere. What this means is that the moral inarticulacy that David speaks of is not so much a function of moral failure or forgetfulness, but rather it is built into the very nature of the contemporary world. Now please, it's really important here in this qualification that you not hear a story of decline. This phenomenon that I'm describing is double-edged. Deinstitutionalization of rules and habits surrounding race and gender is a liberation, okay, that all of us would celebrate. But the deinstitutionalization is, as a general rule, confusing, especially as it bears on identity and the moral life. So that's my first observation, that deinstitutionalization is a structural characteristic of the modern age. It is built in to the world that we live in. We have to think about, deliberate, and choose in ways that we didn't have to. And that's both good and bad. The second observation is this, that if deinstitutionalization mainly takes place in the private sphere, what of the public sphere? We got a flavor for my, a foretaste from my question this morning. The public sphere, the sphere of massive bureaucracies of government and law, business and commerce, labor, education, healthcare, communications, and sometimes religion, is defined by a culture of instrumentalization, utility, efficiency, what Max Weber called functional rationality. Indeed, one of the ways in which elite higher education distinguishes itself is in the extraordinary refinement of this kind of instrumental rationality in practice. A meritocratic elite is reproduced by virtue of the fact that it understands that culture and operates within it better than others. This is the organizational kid. Thus, the dilemma of late modernity takes shape as a familiar duality. On the one hand, you have a powerful public sphere organized around a culture of instrumental and technical rationality, which on its own terms is largely incapable of providing individuals with meaning and purpose. On the other hand, a relatively weak private sphere, which is sometimes distressingly under-institutionalized, and which is structurally unable to provide the reliable guideposts for meaning, purpose, identity, moral direction. So that's my second observation. The third observation is this, and it adds one more layer of complication. When stable institutional patterns, habits, routines are rendered implausible or inconceivable, when older moral codes can no longer be taken for granted, what do? We moderns have no choice but to turn inward into our subjectivity. In other words, if there are no longer reliable guideposts out there that are institutionalized and repeated by others in the social world, what do? We have to turn inward to find the answers, to reflect, ponder, and probe our newfound choices. This is what is called subjectivization. A mid-century German theorist, of course, called this phenomenon permanent reflectiveness. Permanent reflectiveness, and it captures nicely. And in short, subjectivization, that is the turning inward to our subjectivity to find answers to life's most important questions, necessarily follows deinstitutionalization. And subjectivization cannot help but foster a subjectivism within the culture, an orientation marked not so much by vanity and egoism as it is by an incessant preoccupation with the complexities of one's individual subjectivity. Subjectivism, then, is an orientation built into the late modern world. These constitute some of the deep structures of late modernity. It is on top of these historical dynamics that we find a philosophical and political liberalism that celebrates the autonomy of the individual and the authority of their intuitions, and ideologies of market rationality that celebrate the individual freedom of individuals and other actors to initiate, build, consume as market actors. So, if this is correct, it's not at all an accident that we find ourselves in the spot that we are in, and it is not merely forgetfulness that we have experienced for which we simply need to be reminded. The transition David talks about from the culture of humility to a culture of the big me is not merely a matter of moral failure, and I don't want to exaggerate what I don't think David is saying, but what the quandary David talks about instead is in fact built into the nature of the modern world we live in, and it is reinforced by the ideological dynamics of late modernity. And those larger historical and structural forces operate in ways over which the individual has little knowledge and less influence. Now, I'm going to ask the question, what do we do about it? But I want to give an illustration that has been fairly close to home about how some of these things all come together in a controversial illustration. I think it helps to illustrate the moral impoverishment, the impoverishment of our language that David calls our attention to. And it plays out both in public and private life. This is the case of sexual assault, something that has been on the minds of many of us at the University of Virginia in the last couple of years. Needless to say, the dynamics of sexual assault operate in a larger cultural context, one in which the dynamics of instrumental power pervade public and, to a large extent, the private spheres. At the heart of this culture, and at the heart of sexual assault, is an implicit anthropology that conceives of human beings as objects for instrumental ends. When we see human beings as mere objects that have more or less utility, we cannot help but use them, consume them, instrumentalize them in the ways that we consume, use, and instrumentalize other objects and experiences. While objectification and instrumentalization and the anthropology that underwrites them are far from cultural novelties, they are, as I've said, pervasive in the public sphere. They are embedded in the most powerful institutions of our society, the market economy first and foremost, but not least the university. Indeed, as I said, one of the ways in which elite higher education distinguishes itself is in the refinement of this kind of instrumental rationality and practice. So if it's true that an anthropology rooted in objectification and given expression in instrumentalization pervades our public and to a certain extent private cultures, then it has three implications. First, the crime of sexual assault is an extreme, violent, and criminal extension of the very logic that plays out in the university and in late modern culture. It is a logic that we professors and our students share and perpetuate in practice, even if we repudiate it in theory. Second, and it's essential that there be some minimum standard for determining what is lawful and unlawful with regard to human sexuality, and the language of consent has become such a standard. No matter the context, sex can never be forced. Yet sexuality is, historically and cross-culturally, one of the most symbolically freighted phenomena of human experience. Against this, our public vocabulary for making sense of it and determining what's right and wrong, good and bad, healthy and unhealthy about it, tends to come down to that single word. And it's a word that bears a lot of weight. When activists chant yes means yes, no means no, we're giving political articulation to that concept, to that boundary. Now believe me, something is better than nothing at all. At least the language of consent and non-consent is a boundary, and it's a moral boundary. But we should recognize that consent is by itself, absent anything else, a rather impoverished concept, one that is incapable of accounting for nuance, depth, and complexity in human sexuality. What about beauty, intimacy, commitment, not to mention covenant? What's most problematic about the language of consent is that it's the language of transaction, of contract. That means the language of consent is also of a fabric with a larger culture of instrumentality and utility, and therefore incapable of offering an alternative to the very thing it claims to resist. The final irony, oftentimes tragic, is that even the moral vocabulary of consent, as simple and as straightforward as it sounds, turns out not to be so straightforward in the actual encounter of two people moving toward an intimate sexual encounter. It turns out consent has no clear application. This word also has been deinstitutionalized. So, at this point, I just want to say that I think that the problem that David has laid out for us, that we live in a moment when our moral vocabularies are impoverished and that we are inarticulate about the most important questions of our day is exactly right. The practical question for parents, for educators, for citizens, for all of us is what we do about it. For me, this is less a question of individual will as it is a question of space and resources. I'm fond of quoting Charles Taylor on this point. And he says, the issue is what resources can support what sources can support our far-reaching moral commitments to benevolence and justice. And as I've said, the public sphere, dominated as it is by instrumental rationality and utilitarian ethics, provides the thinnest of moral languages. It's something, but it's relatively thin. There are few resources there. Its own impoverishment is reinforced by a tendency to deny particularity in community and creed, and its tendency to deny sacredness. The private sphere is the only place at this point where there is a possibility of deepening the resources for the cultivation of eulogy virtues, of thickening the moral languages and practices that make for good character. But here, too, the instrumentalism of the public sphere encroaches. It does so in many ways, but not least in our consumerism and in the educational establishment through the utilitarian ethics of positive psychology. What we end up with is not, again, the absence of morality, but a thin, mostly bland, generic morality that, in my view, cannot carry the ethical burden of a world like ours and the existential and ethical burdens we carry as individuals. The title of David's book, The Road to Character, is reminiscent of another book about a road to moral improvement, Pilgrim's Progress. We may or may not be heading toward the celestial city, but like Bill Bunyan's Pilgrim, we encounter innumerable difficulties and challenges in our effort to live a good life. We invariably come upon the slough of despond, of hill difficulty, the wicked gate, the valley of humiliation, and are tempted by a considerable expanded Vanity Fair. But unlike Bunyan's Pilgrim, we have to find our way through the labyrinths of modernity. The path to the celestial city, or if you will, the road to character, is still possible, of course. It's just a hell of a lot more difficult than we imagine. Thank you.